Hi, everybody. My name is Sam, and I'm an alcoholic. Good and loud, the way I like it. Thanks. Thank you to the committee for having me. It's truly a blessing and an honor to be here tonight. And I'm just felt overcome with gratitude, even just being in the house here, you know. It was the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that changed my life. You know, I was attracted to the fellowship when I came in here. It was the fellowship that attracted me. I liked coming to the meetings and identifying with the people that were going through what I was going through. And I liked going to the diner afterwards. And I liked going bowling, and I liked going to the movies, and I liked the Chinese food on Friday nights. And I liked going to the movies with everybody. I liked coming to the Bill W. dinner dance within my first 6 months of recovery. But my sponsor said, this is all fellowship. The meetings are fellowship. All these activities are all fellowship. It was the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first 164 pages of our big book, and our 12 suggested steps of recovery that enabled me to change the person that I was and the way that I was living. And I'm extremely grateful for that. They were two distinct entities in my recovery. My sponsor is Eddie R., and he has a sponsor. My home group is Citigroup, best damn meeting in New York City. 54th Street, Lexington Avenue, every day at 12:30. Please come see us. It's an awesome meeting. And my sobriety date is May 2nd, 2001. I haven't found it necessary to pick up the first drink in 14 and a half years now, one day at a time. And and I am extremely, extremely grateful for that. I came in here a falling down drunk. I came in here at the end of a 23-year run, having given up everything, jobs, homes, cars, wives. I didn't care about anything. I wanted the next drink. I came in here helpless and hopeless, or so I thought. And I came in here morally, spiritually, physically, and financially bankrupt. I was at the end of a 23-year run. I picked up as a teenager. I didn't come crawling into these rooms till I was 38 years old, having lost everything, and bounced along a few bottoms until I found AA. And today, I've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. Today, I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. The first 38 years of my life have absolutely nothing in common with the last 14 and a half years. My entire life has changed. It was the only way for me to get sober and stay sober. So, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, the what it was like part is it wasn't working anymore. You know, I drank for 23 years. Picking up as a teenager, I had access to an alcohol. A buddy of mine owned a liquor store, and he would slip me the liquor. And I would stay. I grew up in Bergen County in New Jersey, and I'd stand up on the street corners in my denim jacket with the Rolling Stones tongue on the back and a pint of Jack Daniels or a pint of brandy in the inside pocket, and I'd be freezing my butt off and just standing up there drinking, hanging around with the cool guys, the older guys. And, you know, that's how I started, you know, and I became a guy who had like a pint of Jack Daniels in his high school locker, you know, and I thought that was so cool. You know, I look back in retrospect and I'm like, what was I thinking about? But that's what I was. I was an alcoholic and it was progressive. I got out of high school. My grades weren't good because I drank in high school. I went to a Jersey State school. No shame in that. But, you know, I picked the state school because it was close to the city. I could bounce down Route 17. I could come into the city. I could go to Washington Heights. I could bounce around Manhattan. And, you know, I could stop on the way back at Bottle King and get up to my dorm and beer balls and kegs and, you know, parties. And I went to school to party. And I succeeded in that, you know, but the progression of the diseases, you know, there were consequences. By my, you know, my dorm, they used to call my dorm Rock and Roll Headquarters. And, you know, and again, how cool is that? But by senior year, they kicked me out of housing. They told me they'd be fine without me living there. And I used to, I had to live in my mom's basement and commute up and down Route 17 every day and explain to my parents why they had paid for a year of housing. But I was living in the basement commuting every day, you know. And Richard, but again, it was such a badge of honor. I got kicked out of housing. Awesome, you know. And I got out of college and I did nothing for the first year. I had no discernible skills. There was nobody going to pay me to drink kegs and beer balls. So I got a bunch of dead-end jobs just to have drinking money. And I drank in a bar in Bergen County, a place called Knuckleheads. And Let me tell you, that was another badge of honor. I was known as one of the town knuckleheads. Awesome, right? And I ran my first bar tabs there. How cool is that? Look at me. I can barely keep a job, but I got a bar tab at Knuckleheads. You know? The things I took pride in, shaky at best. But I finally got out of Knuckleheads after sitting on the third bar stool from the end for a year, and I got into the workforce, and I got a job in sales for an international shipping company, and they gave me the crown jewel of their empire. They gave me Midtown Manhattan, and I got a series of raises and promotions based on my ability to wine and dine. The guy who used to cover Manhattan did not know how to take clients out and entertain. They gave me an Amex card, and they told me to work hard and play hard. And I was like, that's what I do. You hit my sweet spot, you know? And that's what it was. And I became one of these guys, mid-80s. And again, I thought everybody drank like I did, but I would get to Smith & Walensky's, Ben Benson's, The Palm, Maloney & Porcelli's. You know all these joints. They're all around the Hilton here. And I'd get there at 11:30, and I knew the bartends, and I'd have a couple pops. And then the client would show up. I'd be like, oh, I just got here. Why don't we have a couple pops before we go to the table? So I'd have a couple more pops. And then we'd go to the table, and I always ordered a bottle of red and a bottle of white. Play it safe. Because apparently one goes with chicken and fish and one goes with steak. Had no idea then. To this day, I got no idea which goes with which. Didn't know. Didn't care. I was going to drink both bottles. So why bother finding out? You know, and I thought it was so sophisticated, Polly Fouché and blah, blah, blah. I was dropping Sauvignon Blanc, and I'm look at me. And I can't stress my love of the after-lunch cordial. I had a period, the Sambuca period, the Grand Marnier era, the Cavassier days. Hennessy, whatever it was. And again, I thought I was so grown up. I would order these things. And the progression of my disease became, you know how they would set the Grand Marnier, they'd bring them in these big snifter glasses, and I'd sit there and swish it around and everything and sip it or throw it down. And, you know, the progression was, I was like, they used to drop beans in the Sambuca, and I never understood why. And I'd be like, don't do that. You're only slowing me down. I got to scoop them out with a spoon, or I got to spit them out. Well, they set the Grand Marnier on fire, and you'd have to blow it out and throw it down. I'm like, all right, that was impressive last week. I need another now. Don't set the freaking thing on fire. I got to keep the drink train moving here, you know? And, you know, I'd get polluted. I'd be in these places for 2-3 hours. I didn't know what to do with myself in the afternoon. I couldn't go back to my office. I couldn't go to see other clients. So I did what any self-respecting alcoholic would do. I used to get on the 6 train every day, and I used to go down to McSorley's. And I'd spend my afternoons drinking dark beer. And again, you know, another claim to fame, you know, another I had arrived moment. I spent so much time in McSorley's, I knew the owners. I knew the bartenders. I knew the waiters. I could go there on St. Patrick's Day when people line up at 6 a.m. to get in the joint. I could walk in any time I wanted, sit at the owner's table until I was puking on myself, going, look at me, puking on myself at the owner's table. How's it going to get better than this? And I firmly believe stuff like that, you know. But lunches were clearly the problem. So I started doing dinners with the clients. And I'd get to Ben Benson's at 5:30, and I'd have a couple pops, and the client would get there at 6. It'd be the same thing. I was just doing it later in the day. And then I'd have to go sit through Les Mis and Phantom and Miss Saigon with the helicopter. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. And, you know, I just wanted them to go home. I could go to the strip club, say they were with me, you know, ring up a check there. And, you know, my grandiosity and the ego and dinners were a problem, so I got married. So I took this beautiful girl, I took her hostage, and she used to, you know, alcohol, Bill W. talks about, alcohol was playing more and more an important role in my decision-making process, you know. My wife and I decided to buy a place in Harmon Cove. It's a gated community on the other side of the Lincoln Tunnel. And we bought it because the condo unit had a built-in wet bar. And there's actually a bar on the property called the Cove Club. And I said, she's now my ex-wife, of course. I said to my now ex-wife, this is the answer to our problems. I can drink in the Cove Club, and then I can walk home and have my nightcap in the den with the wet bar. I won't have to drink and drive anymore. This is the answer to our problems. But it was not, as it says in Bill's story, because I started losing all these jobs. I'll try to get through this. You know, I started losing all the jobs. I would leave the Cove Club. It'd be, when I say there was a bar on the property, it would be me and two other drunks watching Jeopardy, screaming at the screen. These two guys would go home. I'd go into Sea Caucus and continue my drinking. And it got to the point where I couldn't keep a job, and I didn't want to have to, you know, go home and wake up my wife, who was waking up to go to work and pay and support us and pay the bills. So, you know, then I started becoming unfaithful to my wife. And if you've ever been on the other side of the Lincoln Tunnel, I know this is Manhattan, but if you've ever been on the other side of the Lincoln Tunnel, if you've ever seen the York Motel or the Royal Inn, or, you know, I start going to places like this with women who aren't my wife. And, you know, and that cost me my marriage. You know, my ex-wife worked in Hackensack Medical Center. My denial was so deep, she used to bring home the pamphlets on alcoholism. And she used to give them to me and I'd be like, do we know someone who's struggling? Should I get these over to somebody? You know, it was crazy. You know, eventually she left me. She tried to get me help. I was unfaithful. She threw me out. I moved in with a woman who understood me, which meant she sat around and didn't drink all and drank all day and didn't work just like I did. So this was a marriage made, you know, a courtship made in heaven. It was her fault I couldn't get on my feet. So I moved out on her, but now I was 38 and I was homeless. And I moved into my mom's basement where the party had started so many years before. And I was sitting there drinking a quart of Dewars, waiting for the end. I was at the jumping off point. I couldn't imagine. I said, there's no way I can wake up tomorrow and drink. I got to get a job. I got to pay my bills. I got to address these tickets, that, you know, from the municipal thing. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't go one more day without drinking. And it was a very lonely place. So the what happened part is, what happened was, I had gone to my first AA meeting ever by accident. I had gone 2 years prior to coming into AA. So 16 and a half years ago, I went to my first AA meeting, and I really went, I'll just say my dry goods distributor, was it going to be at the meeting? How's that? Is that okay? So my dry goods distributor was going to be at this meeting. And I wanted to see him. You know, I want what I want when I want it. So I went to the meeting. And he saw me. He's like, what are you, out of your mind? So he ran into the meeting. I ran in after him. And I don't want to lose him. And you people went around and shared your experience, strength, and hope. And his wife had left him. And she crashed the car. And she lost the job. I was sitting at this meeting going, you poor people. Oh, my God. It's like a disaster in here. So after the meeting, a guy, Jimmy M., came up to me. And Jimmy M. was one of the old knuckleheads, you know, and I thought he had gone to get the paper or a pack of smokes. He'd been in AA for 10 years. Who knew? Jimmy M. says to me, Sam, it's good to see you here. Are you ready to stop drinking? And as an active alcoholic, I can tell you, I never heard crazier thinking in my life. Like, stop drinking. Why would anybody stop drinking? Like, I didn't even know where he was coming from. Like, what are you talking about? And he said, I thought your life might be getting unmanageable. I said, what the hell does that mean? And he said, I saw you with the dry goods distributor in the parking lot. You're drunk off your ass, and you're here with a woman who's not your wife. I was in your wedding. This isn't your wife. So I was like, I was belligerent to him. He gave me his card. He says, come back when you're ready. I said, I'll come back any damn well time I feel like coming back. Don't tell me when to come back. How dare you? So I went on this another 2.5 year run. I'm living alone in my mom's basement. One day I look in the mirror. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'm at the jumping off point. I can't do it anymore. And I find Jimmy M's card. My moment of clarity. I called Jimmy M. I said, do you still go to those meetings? He said, yeah, every night. So I said, can you take me? So April of 2001, he started taking me to meetings, in and out of the program, in and out. I detoxed around the corner here on 57th Street Medical Arts Building. 4 days of detoxing. I'm like, I don't have a problem. My problem is that I need to pour the Dewars into a glass with ice cubes. I'm drinking it right out of the bottle. Drunks do that. You know, and that was my solution, to leave the detoxing in a glass and some ice cubes. That clearly didn't work. So in and out until I finally hit a bottom. And on a May 2nd, I surrendered. And I went to a 28-day rehab. And I came out, and I just became willing. And you know, I went to the Church of the Good Shepherd in Fort Lee. They told me as soon as I get out, meetings will make or break me. I went to the meeting at the Good Shepherd. I met people like Manny P., Mike R., Steve S., a lot of my friends that came out to support me tonight, Frank A., a lot of these guys, his wife Judy. Everybody was up there to support me and welcome me out of the detox, out of the rehab, and tell me that there was a solution. And it was the first time I understood that this is a we program, that we admitted that we are powerless, that our lives are unmanageable. I finally got with, I need not to go to the bar, not to go to the liquor store. I need to hang around with people that are in this program and working this program. And I asked this guy, Eddie, you ought to sponsor me. And I was clear as day with him. Higher power, God. I'll be skipping those steps. Thank you. That's for the fanatics and the freaks and the hardcore. I got no interest in that hokey pokey, you know, malarkey. And he told me, keep coming. So we went to a step meeting, and sure enough, we read out of the 12 and 12, we read the second step. If I don't have a higher power, why not use the group of Alcoholics Anonymous as my higher power? This is a group of people who have solved their alcohol problem one day at a time, where I couldn't solve it for 5 minutes at a time. So I did that. I started going to the meetings, 2 meetings a day, and I didn't want to let you nice people down. You were nice enough to let me make coffee and greet at the door, so the group became my higher power. And the third step, my sponsor told me I had to turn over my life and my will. I had to change my thinking and my actions. That was a lot of work for me because I was pretty set in my ways. And he implored me to say the third step prayer. And my recovery is entirely based on that third step prayer now, where I ask God to relieve me of the bondage of self. Turns out the court of doers wasn't the problem. My ex-wife wasn't the problem. My girlfriend isn't the problem. My employer's not the problem. I'm the freaking problem. I didn't know that. Thank God for the third step and the third step prayer. And the fourth step, I had been begging my sponsor, let me do it, let me do it. Kept telling me I wasn't ready. Then he tells me I'm ready. I'm like, whoa, let's not rush into anything. Time out. And if anybody hasn't done it, I'm here to tell you I did it. I live to tell about it. I did my fifth step, and it blew the doors open spiritually for me on the program. I sat with God and my sponsor. I shared with a human being what my role in my life had been. And I'm telling you, I was shocked to find out I played a role in my life. Like I said, everything wasn't my employer's fault, my mother's fault, my ex-wife's fault. I play a role in my life. And, you know, the alcohol is just the tip of the iceberg. But, you know, as a result of doing the fifth step, my sixth step, my sponsor says, okay, what did we learn tonight? I learned that I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, I'm grandiose, I'm egotistical, I'm dishonest, I'm unfaithful, I'm a liar. He said, all right, which one of these character defects do you want to hold on to? I said, well, none of them. They're not working for me. He said, good. I want you to go home and start saying the seventh step prayer, where I ask God to take away my character defects so I can be of service to God and another human being. I can't do that when I'm selfish, when I'm self-centered, when I'm unfaithful. I can't be of service to God and another human being. So then I start saying the seventh step prayer as I'm instructed. And the eighth step was a long list for me. I was a roaring tornado through a lot of lives. My sponsor, this was just for me, had me break it into family, friends, and coworkers, then prioritize within each section, and then pray for the willingness to go out in my ninth step and make an amends. And not just tell people I was sorry. I was always telling people I was sorry. Now I was going out and telling people I was, you know, sorry for the harms that I had caused. How can I make it up to you? And most importantly, I want you to know I don't live my life that way anymore. And I just want to say regarding the ninth step, it's never too late to make a ninth step amends. I have a sister that I didn't talk to for 30 years as a result of this disease. For my 10-year anniversary, I reached out to her and I made my amends. She accepted him. And not only is she back in my life, she's here supporting me this evening. Never too late. Never too late to make a ninth step amends. My 10th step, the 12 and 12 tells me it's a series of checks and balances. Not just who did I harm today and who do I owe an amends to. Did I help somebody today? Did I stick my hand out to a newcomer? Did I offer somebody a ride? Did I call somebody else to see how they were doing? Never mind how I'm doing. How's the other guy doing? I saw him at Citigroup the other day. He seemed like he was struggling. Let me text him. Let me call him. So this is, I try to follow that out of the 12 and 12. The 11th step for me, I always share about it. People say, oh, it sounds like a lot of work. For me, it's an easier, softer way. I check in with the program every 2 hours, not an exact science. I don't say, whoop, 9:09, I need to do something. But for me, when I get up at 5:30 every morning, I have a serenity prayer, a third step prayer, a seventh step prayer, prayer for the people that are still struggling. When I get to my desk at 7 a.m., I have 5 morning readings that are sent to me, the daily reflections, the big book quote, a couple other ones, Language of Letting Go. You know, and I read them every morning between 7 and 7:30. Around 10:30, I read the 24-hour book. It's Hazleton. It's not AA approved, but I read it. It helps me. At 12:30, I go to Citigroup. When I'm not at Citigroup, I go downtown to the Seaport Group. But if I'm in Jersey, I go to Barrow Street Mansion. I've seen a lot of friends from those groups here tonight. Thank you for coming out. During the course of the afternoon, I check in with my sponsor, and I ask the men that I work with to check in with me at night. Sometimes I get to another meeting. I don't get to a lot of nighttime meetings, but every now and then I do. And at the end of the day, I pray. Third step prayer, seventh step prayer, 11th step prayer. Gratitude list every night without fail. Gratitude list. I can't believe the gifts that God has given me. So I check in with the program every 2 hours. It helps my sobriety. It helps my serenity more these days than my sobriety. And the 12-step is given back what's been so freely given to me. I sponsor a lot of guys. They come over to my house. My wife makes us dinner. We go down the basement. We open up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we underline and we highlight and we discuss the solution. I know what the problem is. Your boss is a pain in the ass, and your wife's a jerk. I know. But we have a solution. It tells me on page 25 in italics, there is a solution for all my problems found in that book. I do a lot of service. I do a detox commitment every single month in Jersey. I go out speaking several times a month. I go to Rikers Island. I go wherever I'm asked to go. I'm still the treasurer. I'm still making coffee a year ago. Service helps me immensely. And doing service and the 12-step work and giving back, it helps me in my recovery. And, you know, what it's like now as a result of these steps, I have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. I've had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, just like it promises me in that big book. And, you know, what it's like now is the single most important thing I have in my life today is God as I understand Him. Having God in my life, having God as my best friend, someone that I can turn to and I can talk to and I can give my problems to, is immensely, immensely helpful to me in my recovery. Okay? My beautiful wife is here supporting me tonight. My wife, who I was dating while I was still active, helped get me into detox, helped get me into rehab. And next month will be our 13-year wedding anniversary, one day at a time. And you know, my wife stopped drinking to support me when I was counting days. I was lucky to have that kind of support. And she's just never gone back to it. She can take it or leave it. Is that crazy or what? I mean, take it or leave it, you know. But, you know, I have my wife in my life today. I have my sister here. I have another sister that I provide for. I have two beautiful boys. I was told, my wife and I were told we could not have children. We were told, don't try artificial insemination. Don't try in vitro. There's no way the two of you can conceive. And we were trying to adopt a little baby, and the adoption fell through, and we were heartbroken, and she turned up pregnant. My son is 11 and a half years old. He's a gift of these rooms. That's right, little Ethan. Let me tell you, he's been to a lot of meetings. He's been to a lot of meetings. I coach him in baseball, basketball, soccer. We had soccer playoffs last night. We have soccer tomorrow morning, playoffs. I got to get home right away tomorrow morning. And when he was 2 years old, we wanted him to have a little playmate. And the doctor said, we can't explain him. Ethan is an act of God. We can't explain how he's even here with us. It's not going to happen twice. My wife and I went back and we revisited adoption. We adopted little Daniel when he was 6 months old from Korea. And little Daniel is now 9 and a half. 9 and a half. And I coach him in baseball and basketball and soccer. And he's in the scouts now. I had to sleep in the woods with him 2 weeks ago. New York Jew sleeping in a tent in northern New Jersey. Freezing his tuchus off. But it's what I do today because I'm able to. And I know you guys want me to wrap up. We have two other great speakers. But I just want to say, you know, my mom suffers from Alzheimer's and dementia. I had to put her into a nursing home right after my dad died. My dad died long enough to see me get my 90-day coin. He saw me get my 90-day coin and passed away within the next month. And people shared with me, don't drink over it. He waited his whole life to see you get that 90-day coin. But I take care of my mom. I take care of her affairs, and I take care of her in the nursing home. And as a result of this program, I'm able to be a loving son to my mother. I'm able to be a loving brother to my sisters. I'm able to be a faithful husband to my wife. And I'm able to be a kind, loving dad to my two boys. And everything I have in my life is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Sam. It's a great evening. I would now like to introduce our second speaker. Nisa A. is from the Greenwood Group in Brooklyn. Please help me welcome Nisa.
Hi, everyone. My name is Nisa, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Nisa.
My sober date is June 6, 2011, and I remember my first few months in AA coming to the Bill W. dinner, and not understanding how you all looked so clean and happy and dressed up. And, you know, I stayed for the dance, and it was one of the first times I had an opportunity to understand what my new life was going to be like, that I could be this person. My story is basically I one day decided that I was going to drink alcoholically. Like, I literally said, I'm sick of this. I'm going to do this now. And I really thought it was like this choice. And I really thought that it was some bright idea that I had, because I decided that I wanted to check out. Like, I was sick of trying. I was sick of trying to be ambitious. I was sick of trying to do this. I was sick of trying to live up to that. And now, in retrospect, I understand that it was a lot of things that happened before that drink that I never processed. But at the time, I just wanted all that noise to stop. Like, I just didn't want to do it. So I took a bottle from one of my roommates, went up in my bedroom, locked the door, and I started to drink. And it worked. Like, it shut all that noise up. You know, I have a history of depression, and it just stopped all of that, overanalyzing. When am I going to feel better? When am I going to be happy? All of that just shut up, and I was so happy for that. But then it became the thing that I would do anytime I was sad, anytime I was confused, anytime I was nervous, anytime I wanted to see my family, anytime I needed to go for an exam. Like, it just became a huge part of my life that was not social. It was actually antisocial. Like, I usually did it when no one was around. And if anyone ever came to me or was sitting with me and said, oh, I smell alcohol, okay, I'm never going to see you again. Like, I was one of those people. It was very much my little secret, my shame. And when I realized that I actually physically needed alcohol, I thought to myself, this is yet again something you messed up, Nisa. Here you go again. Because my story playing in my head since I was younger was that I was just defective. That I was just this weird misfit who just didn't fit in this world, you know? So that just solidified it for me. It's like, okay, this is what you are now. Now this is your lot in life. And for a while, because I was so secretive and I was so ashamed, I never sought help. Like, I never even talked about it. You know, my family, they're all in Philadelphia, and they would call, and then those calls turned to missed calls because I wouldn't answer. Those missed calls, texts, those texts eventually stop. Because what I would do to my family is, if you call me and if you call me out on anything, I'm going to blow up on you, turn it around on you, say what you did to me, hang up from you, and I'm never going to speak to you again. And I realized that was just me pushing away all these unprocessed feelings. When I was younger, when I was 5 years old, I lost my father very suddenly. One day he was there, next minute he was gone. And my mother, who was 27 at the time with three girls, she was widowed. I didn't understand that. All I knew is, anyone that you love with all your heart, they will not be there. So don't ever do that again. And I spent my life, you know, growing up with the emotional IQ of a five-year-old. Like, I really lived my life with that five-year-old's mind. So it was very much the world was after me. It was very much, I better get everything I can because no one's going to give it to me. If I don't take care of myself, who's going to take care of me? So I was very selfish and was proud of it. You know, I was very much the person who was like, I don't need anyone. I'll do it myself. You better not ask me for anything. No, you take care of yourself. And I lived my life like that, and I was actually really proud of it. But what happened was, I noticed that living in my apartment, which I moved into because my roommate started to catch on that I can drink. And, you know, as an alcoholic, pretty industrious, all of a sudden, you know, I ate top ramen for a couple of days, saved up to get my own apartment so I could drink the way I want. But the problem with that is I was able to drink the way I wanted. And my bottom came up really fast. So you mix depression with drinking every day. And one of the things that I used to do that you guys totally blew my bubble about, I swore I invented this, was vodka in a water bottle. So I would carry around this water bottle with vodka all day. And sometimes I wouldn't even drink it. It was just knowing it was there. And if I ran out, it was knowing that it wasn't there. It was like this obsession. And I went through all of these experiences that I learned about in AA before I got to AA. Like, I tried to stop for a couple days. That didn't work. 3 hours felt like 3 days. I tried to not hide it and sort of socially drink. That didn't work because I would always go too far. And I could never deal with that look in people's eyes where they see that you're kind of going off the deep end. So I stopped doing that. So my world got very tiny. And in my apartment, sometimes I would just get through the work week And Friday was my day. I would like make tacos and like have my vodka and like watch Netflix. And I would sit there and I would think to myself, like, no one's coming to do an intervention on you. Because I used to pray for interventions. I used to seriously actually watch the television show Intervention and like pray for that. Like, I wanted someone to come in with a ticket to Arizona and say, you're going. And what's so funny is I would watch it while I'm drinking, saying, oh my gosh, she is so off the deep end. Like, I would just be like that, and I could relate to the people. So, but here's the thing. When you stop speaking to your family, and you get rid of all your friends, and you don't want anyone around you, no one even knows you're drinking, no one's coming for that intervention. So I had to get out of this some way, and I really did not know how I was going to stop drinking. So I started to believe that it was my choice again, and it wasn't. So one day I'm just, you know, moseying on to school and I'm standing on the subway platform and I have this like horrible feeling of all you need to do is lean forward and it'll all be over. And what scared me so much is that I felt myself pushing forward. Now I've had suicidal thoughts since I'm a kid, you know, that's nothing, any given Tuesday. But it was the idea of my body feeling like it was moving forward. I didn't want to die. Now I know I didn't want to die. I just wanted like all that to stop. This new thing on top of everything. Now I have this alcohol thing. I wanted it all to stop. So I went to a hospital and signed in. I sat down in the emergency room. I was like reading magazine or something. They called me back and I told them what I wanted to do. Now at this point, I'm continuously buzzed. I'm not drunk. I'm just at that maintain level. So I'm not making great choices. So I tell these medical professionals what I wanted to do to myself. And what happens when you tell medical professionals that you want to do that to yourself is they don't let you go from where you are. So I woke up in a rehab and I went into the detox and I didn't understand what was going on, but I do remember the doctor looking at me and saying, you have to stop. Because I'm freaking out at this point because things started locking. Like, they started locking the doors. And I was full blown, and I used to be ashamed of this, but I was full blown in the psych ward. And they started to lock those doors, and I really saw through this man's eyes the only clarity that I had in a very long time, which he said, you have to stop. Now, he just meant stop acting like a fool right now, but I heard it in this whole world changing, you have to stop this. And it was like, that was my intervention. I took it. I said, fine, I'll take it. So, but here's the problem. When I got out of there, I thought, okay, now I hit the reset button. Now I can drink like a lady. Now I can make martinis and drink wine and parrot Merlot with my red meat, you know, my white wine. Like, that lasted for 10 days. And I was right back to the hard vodka, right back into it. And I didn't understand why. And although I felt so ashamed, I said to myself, you know where you can go now. So I went right back to that place. I went right back there and was like, hey, how you doing? You know, long time no see. But what they said was, first of all, they told me about blackouts. I didn't understand blackouts. I never even thought I had them because I would hear other people in the last detox that I went to that, you know, they would talk about blackouts. And I realized, because the doctor was like, you know, do you have blackouts? And I'm like, no. And he's like, well, do you ever wake up and don't know how you got there? Well, yeah. And I realized that a lot of times I would wake up in different parts of my apartment not knowing how I got there. Or if I would, like, do these geographics, what I would do, I would, like, book trips in the middle of the night and, like, go to Savannah and, like, party with the drag queens. And, like, I would do things like that, and I wouldn't remember the end of the night. I would just sort of remember this brown kind of thing. And that scared me, because I started thinking, like, what if I hurt somebody? Now it stopped being about me, which I didn't care about, to be honest. It started being about, what if I do something to someone? What if I snap on someone? I have a lot of anger walking around here. What if I, like, punch someone, hurt them, or whatever. So they told me, you know what, since it was my second time there, they said, you know what, maybe you should think about going to a rehab. And you know me, I was like, yes. And because the one thing about me is I may learn the first lesson the hard way, but I'll listen that second time. And I went to that rehab, and I swear, and I'm not kidding, I had the best sleep in years. because I knew this was the fork in the road. This was the chance. I knew it. I was like, this is it. So I'm over in Staten Island, and I'm like, when I get back over that bridge in Brooklyn, my life is going to be different. And I was 29 at the time, and I said to myself, and I guess this is a form of prayer, I said to myself, my 30s are going to be rocking. Like, and that's all I said to myself, my 30s are going to be rocking. And I think that was some form of prayer, you know. I think about it now, that was some sort of like, can it be, please, you know. And they told me that AA would come up, you know, all the different A's would come up. But when AA came up, I would hear them say things about the water bottle. I would hear them say things about the hiding it in different places in your apartment. Mind you, I lived alone. I don't know who I was hiding it from, but I hid it. It was in the closet. It was in there. It was like, it really was. That's how deeply ashamed I was, to the point where I didn't even want my landlord, if, say, a pipe broke, came up, and I didn't want them to see it. But I heard people, specifically women, talk about that shame. And I heard, like, mothers talk about the shame. And, you know, immediately I thought to myself, well, what are they trying to say, that I can't ever drink again? I'm like, well, what about, you know, drinking at my daughter's wedding when I'm, and mind you, I have no children, but I was already there. But everything that I would come up as a good excuse for not doing this, people from AA would just like shoot it down. And it was to the point where the only time I ever felt like calm was when they came up. And at first I wasn't on the AA train. I thought my counselor was like telling them stuff to make us pay attention. I even like confronted her. I told you that stuff in confidence. How dare you? Like I was not there. But I knew when those people came in, something happened with me. And it took me like a week and a half to finally say alcoholic. And when I did, I burst into tears because it was like admitting it out loud. Even though in my head I used to always call myself an alcoholic. But saying it out loud to people exposed me, and I didn't implode. So it was just like, and it actually felt good. And it was to the point where you guys would come up, and I would like look out the window, turn my chair around, look out the window, look for name badges to come, like, oh, they're coming. Here they come. But the one thing that they told me was make a meeting as soon as you get out of here. So, you know, I took that, because everything that I would think of up until that point, I never could trust it. Like at that point, I could no longer trust my own thoughts. So here's my bright idea. I said, everything that I think about, the first thing I think about, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to do the direct opposite of whatever I think of. I wanted to leave that rehab. I didn't. I wanted to not go to a meeting as soon as I got out of that rehab. So I went. And I went to a meeting, and my second meeting the next day was my home group, Greenwood. And it was like, Lone Greener. And it was like, it was one of those places where you just realize this is where you're supposed to be. Like, the people immediately, like, hey, how you doing? No matter how much I tried to blend into the wall and, like, pick the furthest corner to sit in, they would, like, come to me. And it was like, so what are you going to do tomorrow? And they would circle the meetings and, all right, I'll see you tomorrow. And this one woman, oh, God bless her soul, Diane, this one woman would just walk me around, pizza, coffee. At this point, there was no more job. At this point, there was no more school. You know, all I had to do was to go to AA meetings. And, you know, I was really down for doing everything you guys told me, 90 meetings in 90 days, you know, get a sponsor. I started doing the steps with a sponsor, and it was like, step one, yep, powerless, unmanageable, you got that one. Step two, yeah, this is insanity, so please restore it. And then it was like, step three, well, I don't even have any, but you can take it, I don't care. But four was a problem for me. Four said to me, in my head, all that stuff that I was pushing down with the booze, all that stuff that I was pushing down with anger, all those unresolved feelings, all that 5-year-old's emotions, you were saying to me, bring that up, and I'm going to leave you standing there, and you're going to melt away, and that's where you're going to sit. Like, I really was so afraid of it, just the way I was afraid of admitting that I had an alcohol problem. And I went through two sponsors running from step four. You know, doing all those things you do, calling them when you know that they're at work, texting them, you know, flipping it on them. Well, you're too busy. Like all that stuff. And then finally, after I got fired the second time, I saw this woman, Dawn, at my home group. She came to my home group, and I said, like, I just saw her for like a while. I would just see this woman who seemed bright, smiled. And when she was upset, you still saw that she was working through it. So it was like something that I wanted. I'm like, this woman knows how to process emotions. I want that. And I like ran up to her because I really thought if I didn't do something with getting a sponsor, if I didn't do these steps, I really felt like I was just gonna like fly into the atmosphere. So I knew I couldn't hang out without a sponsor for too long. So I ran up to her and she said, yes. First thing she said is, so how much time do you have? I oh, just celebrated a year. She's like, so how do you feel? I'm all right, you know? She was like, so what do you, well, I'm still depressed and, you know, I'm not very happy to be honest, but I'm happy about that year though, you know? And she was like, well, you're suffering from untreated alcoholism. And she didn't say it nasty. She didn't point her finger. She just told me. That's why. I was like, and I haven't finished the steps. So she told me to come to her house at a certain time, and I showed up, and she said, how free do you want to be? And I was like, pretty free. So so we went through it. And I mean, like, word for word, underlining, highlighting, you know, all that stuff, man. We did it. Like, and it was so cool. And when I got to that step four, at that point, I believed in her so much that I trusted her so much that I was willing to walk through that ring of fire. And let me tell you, here's the funny thing. My spiritual experience happened when I did my step five. This whole time I was running away from that. And that's where me getting better was. Releasing all those things, you know, saying to this woman all of these things that I thought were just horrible. Finally seeing my part in things. And some of the things that I was upset about, I would say, oh, you know, I don't really want to tell you this, but, and she's like, okay, well, I've done that twice. What else you got? And I'm like, all right. So I was able to get all that stuff out. And then after that, it was just, it was kind of smooth sailing because that was my biggest fear. I know sometimes people have fear of step nine. Some people have fear of two. Four was my deadly enemy. And when I got through that with step five, I was ready to go. And you know, when I got to step nine, I wasn't afraid, actually, because then at that point, I already realized that number one on four, she went right to number one on nine, my mother. You know, like, I was like, okay, well, I know where that's going. And I called her, and I told her, you know, what I'm doing and everything, and she's just so freaking supportive, although for years, I thought she was against me in my head. She's so freaking supportive. She was like, oh, that's so awesome. That's so great. And then she started saying apologies from her end. And what happened was she wound up coming up to my group's anniversary that year. Like this woman who I thought would disown me, thought I would, she would be ashamed of me, all these things that in her head, I put all these thoughts in her mind. She was so supportive. Now our relationship isn't the best, you know, mother daughter, you know, but it's a lot better now. Now when I call her, she's like, oh, you sound happy. And it's like, I believe her. She told me since birth. She'll know whether I'm happy or not. And, you know, now what I do is I now have a sponsee, which my ego said that I was going to make her go out. My sponsor was like, no, first of all, calm down. Second of all, you do the same thing with her that I did with you. And she said, put your niece a twist on it. Put your story in there. And I did that. And I'm able to watch this girl, like, grow from tears, you know, every stress in the world, unhappy, miserable, to this girl who's just like, she brightens my day sometimes. Like, she'll call me with all her issues, and at the end of it, but God is good, and she's like, but it's okay, and it is what it is, and I'm going to keep moving, and no one's going to stop me, and it's just like, yeah. So I really look to women in AA for a lot of support. Now, and it may not even be support one-on-one. It may be just seeing someone, watching someone grow in AA, watching women do things in AA that is just like motivation for me. Like, AA really taught me how to be an adult woman, and I'm not joking. Like, it really taught me how to stand on my own two feet, be proud of myself, have confidence. You know, what came out of that is I'm able to have a sober relationship. I'm able to, like, laugh and giggle with my boyfriend about, you know, oh, my God, I'm going to speak at Philadelphia. You can't believe that. You know what he did for me this morning? He made me pancakes. Like, that's what I'm talking about. That's love and support. Like, so, like, all I try to do now is, first of all, remember that I'm flawed because I always had this problem when I was drinking and I was, you know, I had to be perfect. I'm flawed. I'm going to make mistakes. I made this message tonight may not be the smoothest that I've ever wanted it to be. My mouth is pretty dry right now, but I just wanted to get it out and share it because I know if I felt like the way I felt, somebody else in here is feeling that. And it doesn't matter how much time you have, you know, and I want to give a shout out to all those people who relapse and come back and tell us about it. Because I listen to you. I'm one of those people who listen. So I just want to say thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. I really want to say thank you. Like, spread the word that Nisa said thank you. Because my life is so much different now. And I'm going to tear this dance floor up tonight. Yeah. And I thank you all.
Whoa. What a night. Thank you, Nisa, so much. Our third speaker, I didn't have anything to do with speaker selection, and I'm happy about that because the third speaker is a dear friend and somebody who came to the morning meeting when I was getting sober at the 79th Street Workshop, us people who couldn't sleep at 7:15. And he's a real special man. Our last speaker is Jamie from the Keed Mila Falcha group in Queens, which means 100,000 welcomes in Gaelic. So 100,000 welcomes, Jamie.
My name is Jamie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jamie.
This is such a privilege, such an honor and a privilege for me and for my family, for my wife who's here and my sisters who's here. And I'm just so grateful, and thank you. Thank you for this great honor. I'm here tonight because I don't want to drink, and I'm here tonight because I was asked to serve. My sobriety date is February 13th of 1988. My sponsor's name is Jeff W. of Maplewood, New Jersey. And my home group is Cade Milafalte in Woodside, Queens, and there's a couple of us here. It's not as big as Citigroup, and it's not as fabulous as Midtown Manhattan, but it's a dynamite Sunday night step group there. You're all welcome, although it's a small room, so don't come all at once. So I grew up in Sunnyside, Queens, and my parents were good people. They were smart people, educated, middle-class people. They tried their best to live a good life. There were high hopes for them when they got married. And they were also chronic alcoholics, and they struggled. They suffered from this disease. And my father was a kind of Jekyll and Hyde drunk, and my mother was more of a pass-out. She would just pass out unconscious. And there's a storage room in my house where my sister and I would hide from my father when he would burst in the door. We'd drag my mother in there and hide. He would burst in the door. He'd run around the house screaming and yelling, and hopefully he'd pass out on the couch, and we would tiptoe back to our beds. And I have this one memory it's one night when he found us in that storage room, and he chased us out of there. And I have this memory of my sister and I clutching each other, trembling with total fear as he attacked my mother. I remember promising my sister we would never drink, and we would never do this to our kids if we ever had kids. And I have some great memories of childhood too. I've got some, it was an up and down, chaotic, it wasn't all bad. But when I was 10 years old, a couple of years later, maybe a year or so after that, I had my first drink. I could tell you exactly where I was, who I was with, how awful it tasted. And, by the time I was 12 or 13, we were sneaking off with quarts of Colt 45 and Budweiser, and we were, drinking in parks and playgrounds, and, I loved it. I loved it. I loved what alcohol did. I loved the altered state of mind. I loved that I had an enormous capacity for drinking alcohol as a teenager. I was really I could drink a lot. I could drink a lot, and I could drink more than people older than me. And I thrived on the reputation of being a party animal. And New York City was a very different place back then. I don't see like 13, 14, 15-year-old kids, drinking in public. Maybe they are, and I miss it. I don't see them. But we drank everywhere. We drank in, on stoops, on front stoops of brownstones in every neighborhood. We drank in on the rocks in Central Park. We drank. I was smoking a pack of Marlboro Reds. I had my Marlboro Reds, and I was so cool. I drank Mr. Boston Blackberry Brandy, only the best stuff. And Sam said earlier, you know, I felt like I had arrived when I had a bar tab in high school, like in some dive bar. Some people talk about geographics, like my geographics were, if I drank in Sunnyside, Queens, I would become an alcoholic. But if I drank in Manhattan, there was something more sophisticated about it. So even though I was kind of stumbling home and blacking out, as long as I was drinking in Manhattan, it was okay. I was renting out lofts and throwing dance parties in high school, charging $5 all you could drink. I was big into the all you could drink special. I don't see that much anymore either. There was a place called Beefsteak Charlie's that had all you could drink. With some of you remember it. They had a number of locations, and I remember testing the limits of the all-you-could-drink policy. And I remember these poor staff people, like, you know, arguing with me over, like, you know. I had my fake ID that I got from Times Square for $5, and it worked. And I went to places like Danceteria and the Palladium. And thank you. Yeah, I kept saying, you know, you could see Madonna the next time you're there. You know, I never saw it in Madonna, but I got in with my fake ID, and I loved it. You know, it was great, and as terrifying as growing up in an alcoholic home was as a child, being a teenage alcoholic, it was great. Because, you know, I came and went whenever I wanted. Nobody could tell me anything. If you wanted to talk to me about my drinking, you could go to hell. My parents didn't have a leg to stand on. I justified, you know, stealing money from my family. I justified violence. I justified, you know, coming and going as I pleased. You know, at home, you know, as my parents' alcoholism progressed, home became more difficult and holidays became impossible, and my mother was shipped to California. She got a one-way ticket to live with her sister. And it was just me and my dad then. And I remember telling my father, I'm not hiding from you anymore. And, you know, if you come in this house drinking, I'm going to beat the crap out of you. And I did. And, you know, I remember seething with rage, you know, being angry enough to really hurt him, sending him to the hospital and not feeling bad about it at all, just justifying my violence and, you know, just feeling self-pity and rage was just, you know, throughout. So then I got accepted into school in Albany, and I went to school upstate, and any controls that I had on my drinking here were totally gone in Albany. And I was drinking, you know, whenever I wanted, wherever I wanted. I ran into some other recreational activities that probably accelerated my bottom. And I met a beautiful girl named Alexa Jellybean Averill, if I could say her last name. She died recently. She was a beautiful girl, and I really liked her. And she liked me better when I didn't drink. So I kept trying to, and in a moment of clarity, I was, you know, I used my rough childhood story to win sympathy, believe me. But I was also, had a moment of clarity, and I was very honest with her about how alcoholism destroyed my family, my aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins and, you know, alcoholism throughout my family. So I had this moment of clarity, and I was honest with her about my drinking and about this family disease. And I tried, you know, I tried to start not drinking, you know, and wanting it to work out with her. And it just, you know, it was a disaster because I would show up, you know, we'd have plans, we'd have a nice, you know, date or evening planned, and I would show up drunk. I would plan, you know, this time I'm going to just behave myself, I'm just going to have two, you know, and it was, you know, later I found out I had an allergy to alcohol that wouldn't allow me to stop at one or two. And, you know, she ended up going to a different school. We had a long-distance relationship, and I started to... You don't hear much about this anymore, but we would call each other after 11 o'clock at night when the rates went down. So this caused me to have to sort of drink earlier and then sober up by 11 so that I could get through this 11 o'clock phone call and then go back to the party. And, you know, one time I didn't time it very well. And she knew, like, the minute I said hello, I was drinking. And and she wouldn't talk to me. And I want to just say, through the miracle of Facebook, I recently found her brother, Craig, who's sitting at table 108, who celebrated 24 years of sobriety this week. And so Craig is her brother. So I want to say to Craig and to everybody who goes over there to wish him a happy 24-year anniversary that I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for his sister. And I owe her, she'll always be an angel for sending me to deal with this. So I went to the campus shrink in Albany, and I started telling him my life story. And I had, like, 5 minutes into my appointment with the campus shrink, he said, "Stop talking, stop." He said, "We have nothing to talk about until you go to AA." So I went to AA. I heard the words powerless over alcohol at my first meeting. I thought that made sense to me. Nothing much else made sense, but the words powerless over alcohol suddenly, you know, sort of made things sort of I understood those words, powerless over alcohol. That explained a lot of what had happened to me so far. My second AA meeting, I walked in, I sat down, this woman, this older gal sitting next to me, kind of leans into me and says, "Are you new here?" I said, you know, I wasn't sure how to answer that question because I didn't want to say. And I should also tell you I had a black eye from a fist fight a couple of days earlier. And I had my new wave hairdo. And I kept thinking, I wonder why she thinks I'm new. Anyway, so I finally, after a long hesitation, I finally said, "Yes, I am new here." And then she leaned in closer and she said, "I want to welcome you to the most amazing spiritual journey that you could ever imagine." And I got up and I moved my chair to another part of the room. So I didn't know what the spiritual journey meant. I didn't know what you're talking about God for. I could admit that I couldn't stop drinking. I could admit that I had some other problems. But I couldn't understand what this God business was all about. But I kept coming, you know. You know, we talk about the traditions at our step meeting on Sunday nights. And, you know, the traditions, we talk about them like they're these faraway things that have nothing to do with my recovery. But the three traditions, the third tradition, the seventh tradition, and the 12th tradition kept me coming. You know, they kept me coming here when I didn't know what you people were talking about. The only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking. I understood that I had that and right to be here as much as anybody else. The average age of recovery in Albany AA at the time was like 100. And I was 19 years old at the time. And the seventh tradition was, you know, I could put a dollar in the basket or not. You know, we're self-supporting through our own contributions. So I was kept waiting for the catch that was going to come, like, "We need you to buy something. We need your credit card. We need to, like, you know, pay some monthly fees." And I was, like, really kind of half hoping that somebody was going to come at me with wanting money. And, you know, it was like, put a dollar in the basket or not. Now we should put more than that because it costs a lot more money to pay rent at Manhattan AA meetings. Yeah. But nobody asked me for my credit card number or any money, and I was like, okay. And then the 12th tradition was also kept me coming, which was you didn't want to know my last name, you didn't want to know my zip code, you didn't care what I did for a living or who I was welcome here as much as anybody else. So those traditions really kept me coming for the, you know, as much as your other suggestions at the time didn't make any sense, like 90 meetings in 90 days, absolutely not, like I was too busy. You wanted me to get a sponsor, and I thought, I'll get to that once I kind of get my life together a little bit. And the God thing was just like, I'll avoid that altogether. And service commitment was like, ooh, like, are you kidding me? Make coffee? Like, I'm busy, you know, I've got stuff to do. So I kept coming, and you know, I was pretty belligerent, and I had one foot in and one foot out, but I kept coming. And on February 13th of 1988, I got drunk again. And somehow, some way, I crawled back to this meeting on the outskirts of AA. I had on the outskirts of Albany. It was the outskirts of AA. It was the outskirts of Albany. And I raised my hand. I told them what happened. I felt like, I was 19 years old. I could have drank some more. But I was at the bottom spiritually and emotionally and mentally. I was totally at the bottom. I was, I felt completely alone. I felt like I was doomed to a revolving door of 30 days, 60 days, drunk again, 30 days, 60 days. I thought that was what, I was doomed to, to what happened to my parents. And I was doomed to that, what I saw happen to my family. And I thought there was no way out. And I saw my father. I saw myself becoming my father. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to make it. There's no way. This is not going to work for me. AA doesn't work. I know all about AA. It doesn't work. I don't know exactly what I said at that meeting, but I told them how I felt. I told them what happened. I told them that it was the loneliest Valentine's Day weekend that anyone ever had. And this other older gal came up to me after the meeting, and she said, Jamie, we've been listening to your New York City slicker BS for 4 months now. She used much harsher language than that, by the way. And there have been a number of older gals in AA who've really never hesitated to pull me aside and really tell me how full of crap I was. And this was one of the first. And they're all very helpful. But this lady said to me, she said, Jamie, tonight I heard you surrender. I've been listening to you complain and tell us how different you are. And, I used to tell people, what are you people talking about DWIs for? I never had a DWI. What the hell? And then somebody helpfully pointed out that growing up in New York City, I didn't have a car or a driver's license. So, all these upstate people, whatever. So, my denial was chipping away. So she said, you surrendered tonight. I heard you surrender. Keep surrendering. And I kept coming, and I still didn't think this was going to work. And then, at 19 days, I heard a guy named Bob the Plumber in Albany, AA. There were two Bobs at the time. There was Belt Buckle Bob and Bob the Plumber. And Bob the Plumber said to me, at 19 days, I was really struggling at day 19. I don't know what it was about, but it was really a tough one. And he said, "Be here now." He said, "Be here now." He said, if you keep coming, if you stick with us, if you do what we do, and you just, I want you to really soak in day 19, really, really be here now and experience day 19 for as crummy as it is or as great as it is or however it is, you don't ever have to come this way ever again. This doesn't have to happen. And I thought, all right, I heard that. At 90 days or about 90 days, I walked into the 79th Street workshop. They have a sign on the wall that says, "Ask for help." I raised my hand and I asked for help. I really asked for help at that meeting. Somehow, in a forest of hands, my hand got picked on from the speaker. I asked for help. I knew where to drink in New York. I knew where to get, into all sorts of trouble. I didn't know how to stay sober, and I needed help, and I asked for help. That day, everything changed. Everything changed at that meeting. Right after that meeting ended, I met Pompous Peter. He came up to me. Pompous Peter got sober in Bristol, England. He was such an amazing character. He's called Pompous Peter because when he got sober in Bristol, England, they told him only to go to meetings where they had double doors so his head could fit through. So, he used to say that all the time. So he said, I heard him share, he said something like, I'm not going to try to do a bad British accent, so bear with me. But he said something like, all my life, all I ever wanted was a Bentley. And today, he said, today I rode my bicycle through Central Park with an unemployment check in my pocket, and I realized I was happier than I'd ever been in my life. And I wasn't sure I even knew what a Bentley was or what the hell he was talking about. But he was, but it was enough for me to say, I want what he's got. He asked me if I was willing to go any lengths to stay sober. I said, sure. I had no idea what he was talking about. I had a lot that I wanted to get off my chest. I had an agenda. I had a rough childhood story. I had a problem with my sister. I had a job that was like, you know, I didn't like the job that I had. I had all sorts of, you know, things that I wanted to get off my chest. And he would say, "We'll get to that," he said. "But first, let's talk about the doctor's opinion." And we studied, like was said earlier, we studied this literature line by line, you know, and I just went through it with him. I just went through it with him because I really didn't have anything else. You know, I had nowhere else to go. I heard him. I was able to, you know, he was another person who was very loving and very kind, but also was very quick to tell me how full of it I was. And I was able to just set aside all the stuff that I needed to get off my chest urgently that I needed to talk about. And we talked about the doctor's opinion. We talked about Bill's story. He used to name the chapters of the big book. He'd say, "You know, it's called There Is a Solution, not There Are Problems." And he'd say, "You know, chapter 5 is called How It Works, not How It Happens." And he was a real student of the big book, and he was a student of AA history, and he got me really excited about the people that we read about earlier. You know, this stockbroker goes to Akron, and they meet, and they, you know, he meets this proctologist, and they're all from Vermont, and Dr. Silkworth, and it's like the pieces of the puzzle have solved, like, you know, centuries of alcoholism is now, like, been solved by people. And this guy's 81st anniversary is tonight. And, like, we wouldn't even know each other if this guy hadn't gone on that business trip and went to the hotel lobby. And he would talk about our history with such excitement that, and we would go to, he took me to Vermont, to East Dorset, and we went to the birthplace of Bill, and we studied the book. And, you know, it was urgent that this is powerful, like, story that we got to be, you know, he traced back the career officer on page 517 was actually, you know, he was my great, 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 you know, like he figured out how many sponsors back was, I was linked to the career officer. And it was like, "You're in the big book." You know, it was like real. So it was like, it was exciting, you know, and we just, you know, we studied this stuff and somehow, some way, like a life like beyond my wildest dreams actually, you know, sprung up around me. And when I had a year and a half sober, I started things, really amazing things started happening. I got to go to Ireland, and I went to, I was accepted to study at a prestigious school in Dublin, and I got to hitchhike all across Northern Ireland. A lot of people said, "Don't do it, it's dangerous, there's a lot of violence up there." I went to youth hostels, and I stayed with family members, and I was hitchhiking across Ireland. And I went to AA meetings in every single town. I joined a group in Dublin, and when I was hitchhiking across Ulster, I had this incredible spiritual experience where I met this guy who had been sober. He was like 35 years old, and he got sober when he was 19. And he was like, he was driving me from the meeting to the youth hostel, and he was like, "I wouldn't even know who this guy, what his name is, or what he looks like today. But he was like, 'You can do this. You don't have to drink again.'" And I thought, he's like, I stayed sober all this time, so can you. And it was like these miracles, these little things. And I wouldn't have gone if I hadn't been encouraged to go by Eileen, who's sitting at table 33, who's here tonight, who I'm so grateful that she's here. My friend Eileen said, "Go, you should go." Because I was like, "I'm not going to make it." She was like, "You should go." And she supported me. And there's a lot of people in here tonight, this room tonight, who supported me and encouraged me and said things that saved my life. When I had 6 years sober, my whole world fell apart when my father was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And, you know, we found out he was going to die very soon. And, you know, because I had worked these steps, because I had worked the steps with my sponsor, and because I had, you know, I had been able to make amends for the stuff I had done and been able to forgive my father for what he had done, I got to show up for my father and be there for my father, moved in with him, and got to, you know, it was not a Hollywood happy ending, but there was like love and service, and God was involved when he passed away, and I got to show up for him, and I'm always gonna. It was one of the greatest gifts that I could ever have been given. You know, 2 years later, the same thing happened with my mom, and you know, Pompous Peter. I remember him telling me when I got the call, like, "How am I going to get through this?" And he said, very simply, he just said, "Well, I guess you're the spiritual leader of your family." And nobody ever called me the spiritual leader of anything. And but I was carried through that period of time by you people and by, you know, my fellow AAs. And, you know, I remember complaining to him about my job that I had where I had to punch a time clock. And it was I was working in a bookstore. And, you know, he said, maybe you need to punch a time clock because you need to learn how to show up places on time, which was very harsh. But but I was a book clerk in this very, very popular bookstore in Midtown, and I was shelving books. And I walked into the book buyer's office. She was very busy and very unapproachable and not somebody a book clerk would walk up to and talk to. But I walked into her office and I said, you know, I notice in our self-help section we don't carry a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm told, you know, by a friend of mine who said, it's the story of how the, you know, the first 100 recovered from alcoholism, it's the basic text of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We should carry it in this bookstore. She said, interestingly, she said, we used to carry that book. She said, but we don't carry it anymore because it didn't really sell. There was an explosion of, like, really, really big self-help books that were big sellers at the time. And she said, the problem with that book is it forces the reader to accept too much responsibility for their situation. And what we find is the stuff that really sells is, like, allowing the reader to blame other things and other, you know, situations. I said, okay. I said, thanks. I'm, you know, back to the shelves. And from that day forward, anytime anyone ever approached me in the self-help section looking for a book on alcoholism, I would pull them aside and I would write down the number for New York Intergroup and say, get out of here. Call this number. They have the right books over here. That bookstore is out of business, by the way. So 9 years ago, I began a brand new spiritual journey. I became a father, and my beautiful wife is here, and we have three kids. We have a 9-year-old boy, we have a 7-year-old girl, and we have a almost 2-year-old baby girl. I'm very blessed. Thank you. And none of these people have seen me drink. When I put my key in the door when I come home from work, nobody's walking on eggshells. Nobody's afraid of me. And a story for another time is the story of how I actually live in the house that I grew up in, which is another surreal and incredible thing that's happened. So I live in the house where I grew up in. And the storage room that I was telling you about earlier where I would hide with my sister is we just did some renovation. And we renovated a bunch of the rooms in the house, and the wreckage of my past has now been remade in that house. That house is now a place where, you know, I walk in the door and like half the neighborhood is there on a play date. And this was a house like where nobody was ever invited in. People couldn't come in that house. The storage room where I used to hide with my sister is now a beautiful bathroom for my kids, and we got a big, beautiful bathtub in this room. And recently, I was treated to a bubble bath with my little guys all fussing over me and making sure I had my newspaper and candles lit. And this is literally the scariest place in my life, is now the happiest, best room in the house. And thank you. The book says that that we can cling to the idea that our dark past is our greatest asset, and that's the truth for me. And when I sit in that bubble bath and I think, you know, do I regret the past or wish to shut the door on it? I say, I don't think so. You know, when we close our meetings, we all hold hands, and I was thinking about all the people who've held my hand, you know, and who've helped me. Eileen, who's told me to go to Ireland, and Peter Webb, and I can tell you his name because he died a long time ago. He died like 10 years ago. Now Jeff, his sponsor, is my sponsor. But Peter and Bob the plumber and, you know, countless people who I don't know their last names and I don't know who they are or what they do for a living or how much money they make. They've saved my life, you know, and they've held my hand and they've kept me sober. And I owe them everything. I owe you everything. So thank you for my sobriety.